This is Ahval Online, meeting point of accurate news and free comment on the current affairs of Turkey. Welcome to our podcast series.
Hello, and welcome to Talking Turkey. I'm your host, Ahval editor David Lepeska, and with me today is Berk Esen, international relations professor at Ankara's Bilkent University. Hello, Berk, and thanks for joining us.
Hi, David. Good to be here.
Good to have you. We are speaking on Wednesday, July 8th, and there have been rumors spreading today on Turkish social media that the Council of State, which as of last Thursday had 15 days to decide whether to reconvert Istanbul's iconic Hagia Sophia into a mosque, has indeed voted to do just that. There's no official word just yet, but Hagia Sophia Mosque is already a trending topic on Turkish Twitter as Islamists and nationalists begin to celebrate. Let's say the rumors are true, Berk, and that the council has decided to turn Hagia Sophia Museum, what it is now a museum, into a mosque. What would that mean for Turkey? Well, first, what would it mean for Turkish politics, for Erdogan and his ruling AKP? And second, what would it mean for the way Turkey is seen, you know, by the mainly Christian West?
I mean, of course, if Hagia Sophia is turned into a mosque, it's going to be a very symbolic move. As you probably know, the mosque was turned into an important museum in 1934. And ever since then, and particularly since the 1950s, when Turkey transitioned to a multi-party democracy, this has been an electrifying issue that has polarized the society between the conservative pious masses that have been mobilized by various right-wing populist parties, and the more secular middle classes. And so if it is finally turned into a mosque, it's going to be seen as a symbolic victory for Erdogan and the Islamist movement. You know, it's sort of in some ways quite similar to the construction of a mosque in the Taksim Square. You know, that was a signature issue for Tayyip Erdogan since his days as mayor of Istanbul, and he has succeeded in doing that. And he may actually do the same with Hagia Sophia. Having said that, I don't think that this is really going to change things in concrete terms for Erdogan in the political arena. I don't think that this is, the Hagia Sophia mosque issue is really an old issue. This is sort of a Cold War cultural battles that Erdogan has been waging. For much of the electorate, and particularly for the young voters, Hagia Sophia is not really an important issue. For them, what is really much more important is obviously lack of good job opportunities, lack of educational opportunities, the economic downturn, particularly against the backdrop of a pandemic that has not really subsided. So I don't think that Erdogan will be able to expand his voter base. Probably he will use this to solidify the Islamist voters and rally them around his cause, as he has always done it. And he may try to turn this into a sort of a symbolic victory against Istanbul's current mayor, secular mayor, Ekrem İmamoğlu. But other than that, I think in concrete terms, not much will change in the coming years, even if it's turned into a mosque.
It's interesting. You say that it's been an electrifying issue politically for years and years. I wonder, does the AKP, does Erdogan lose something if it does become a mosque because he no longer has this issue to bring up to electrify the base?
Exactly. So he will, first of all, he will lose that. With these kind of issues, probably for pragmatic politicians, it's much more important to keep such issues alive so that they will be able to mobilize their voters as opposed to achieve such symbolic victory, which then compel even those voters to realize that not much has changed in their lives. It's going to be a Fidic, victory in the sense that the overall economic status of the voters will not change that much. Erdogan will get some kind of a backlash in the international arena. I know that both the Russian and the U.S. government have criticized such a move. Probably some European politicians will also be against this move. Now, this is not to suggest that Erdogan will not then use these kind of criticisms coming from the from other governments as a way to mobilize his base, but you know, in concrete terms, I don't really see things changing all that much, even for Erdogan's base.
Okay. I'm not sure you saw it. You just mentioned Turkish youth, though, but a Deutsche Welle story last week detailed how the government had moved up the date of the annual college entrance exam in Turkey, which is a hugely important day in Turkey for Turkish students and their parents, who generally come and sit and outside the school or the venue and wait for their children to take the exam. The government moved it from late July, where it had initially been, to late June, just last week or about 10 days ago now, which upset the students, who suddenly found themselves with considerably less time to study for an exam that could determine their career path and their future. Mm-hmm. And this was all because apparently the government wanted to begin the summer tourist season earlier in an effort to revive the industry in the wake of the pandemic. And then when Erdogan went on YouTube the day before the exam to talk to Turkish students online, he was blasted with thousands of taunting and critical comments. And then young students went to Twitter, where the hashtag, quote, not getting my vote, went viral as this so-called Generation Z expressed their anger at Turkey's leader. Berk, what do you make of all this? This generation born around the start of the new millennium is expected to represent about 12% of voters by the time of the next vote in 2023. Are they as much against Erdogan as it seems, and could they be decisive in the next election?
Certainly. I mean, if we were to do a generational analysis of Turkish politics, I think it would be quite safe to suggest that older voters tend to be more conservative and a lot more supportive of Erdogan and his party and his government than younger voters, for all sorts of reasons. You mentioned Generation Z. These are the millennials who have been born in the 2000s and afterwards. Of course, they were born into a world in which you had social media and internet that was quite widespread. Many of the members of the Generation Z have been born in big cities, and so they have access to schools much more than their parents, at least on average. And obviously, they take many things for granted. They take going to school and then getting a good job and getting a certain level of quality life as given, which is quite different from their parents and their grandparents, many of whom were born in the Anatolian heartland in probably very modest conditions and have begun to move to the big cities starting from 1970s and onwards. And so for these older generations, the Islamist movement, which has, as you probably know, which have been controlling major metropolitan municipality governments, particularly Istanbul and Ankara, since 1994. So for these older generations, it was always the Islamists who were in power, first in local government and then in national government. And it was the Islamist politicians who have provided them with social assistance, and all sorts of public provision goods, including electricity, paved roads, transportation opportunities, and so on. And so probably older generations are a lot more grateful to having a certain level of income and certain quality of life in big cities, particularly thanks to AKP and Erdogan, because, of course, between 2002, when AKP first came to power, and 2013-2014, Turkish economy grew not so much exponentially, but in quite high numbers. This was the period in which Turkish economy really integrated into the world markets, and Turkey became an extremely urban society. Right, so that's why this goodwill, this support for Erdogan trickles down, even at a time of economic downturn. However, for the young generation, so if you're born in 2000s, you know now no other leader besides Erdogan. And so for them, Erdogan is a leader who's growing old, right? You know, he's 67 years old, and who's somewhat out of touch with their issues, who comes across almost as an angry father figure, right? Sort of like probably their own, the sort of figures that they see in their own lives, especially.
But saying that, you could kind of see how also that would make them unlikely to vote against him, because you don't vote against your father even if you disagree with him, you know?
Well, you don't maybe openly criticize him, but I don't know about not voting against a father figure. I think looking at the opinion polls, it's becoming clear that members of the Generation Z are willing to throw their support behind the opposition. And the fact that Erdogan and those around him are picking these cultural battles with Twitter and other social media organs and also are picking quite conservative positions on various social issues is, I think, backfiring. And so if I were the AKP government, I would be very, very worried about this generation. You said that they make up only 12% of the electorate, which is true. And probably in many Western countries, young people's votes do not really change elections all that much. But in the Turkish context, as you know, the last few elections have been quite close. And even a 2 to 3 percentage point swing would really change things dramatically. So the government should be quite worried about this issue.
Well, right. I still think it seems kind of uncertain which way they will go. A June study by the Gezi Research Center took a look at these estimated 13 million or so young Turkish voters, or some of them are voters now, some of them will be voters soon, and found that they are more environmentally concerned than previous generations, that they have significantly more influence on how their parents vote than their parents' generation has had on them, interestingly. Generally, they, as you say, they do not share the conservative values of the AKP, and perhaps more importantly, more than a quarter of them right now don't have jobs, as unemployment for young Turkish citizens has hovered around 25%. As you say, this sounds like a lot of bad news for Erdogan and the AKP, yet many of these dissatisfied youth have talked about, in this study, they talked about A, not voting for any party because they see all of them as problematic, and B, leaving the country to seek their future in Europe or the US, which would mean they probably won't vote at all. So to some extent, it still seems like their impact on the next vote is a question mark.
I mean, you know, this is an excellent question. I you know, you're totally right that you know, the fact that members of the Generation Z will not vote for Erdogan doesn't mean that they're going to automatically vote for the opposition, right? They have alternatives. One alternative is leaving the country, as you just mentioned. But of course, I don't think that these young people will be able to leave the country en masse. For all sorts of reasons. One, during a time of pandemic, even Western countries are looking inward, and I don't think that there will be many job opportunities in the US, in Canada, or across the European Union. So it's going to be a bit more difficult for them to leave the country. And also, Turkey, unlike countries like Hungary and Poland that are undergoing a similar transformation of a populist movement that is turning the country into a more autocratic place and a more nationalist place. Turkish citizens do not automatically get job permits within the EU because Turkey is not a member of a European Union. So again, it's going to be a lot more difficult for these young people to leave en masse. The best and the brightest are trying to leave, and some have left. And that's a major concern. But the numbers are not as high that the Generation Z will not matter in elections. But of course, you're completely right that the opposition parties cannot really take for granted these voters. And they really need to actively recruit their support. They have to figure out a way of appealing to members of the Generation Z. And you know, not being AKP will not really do the trick. They have to be able to come up with active issues, like active support on certain issues that members of the Generation Z really care about. And probably they need to also incorporate members of this generation into their political parties, right? So some of these people, some of these youngsters need to become candidates, at least need to really join these political organizations in order for opposition parties to carry a lot of weight within that generation. So I think Erdogan is beginning to really seriously lose the Generation Z vote, but the jury is out in terms of how the vote will go, whether these people will basically become quite apathetic and not vote, or whether they will go for the opposition is to be seen. I think the latter may happen. Some of these opposition parties are trying to come up with new innovative ways using social media, even TikTok videos. But those parties are still at the early stages of making that move. And they need to do more, substantially more.
Another reason Turkish voters have turned away from Erdogan is a perceived slide into authoritarianism and away from the rule of law, particularly since the failed coup of 2016, which will mark its four-year anniversary next week, after which the government, of course, enacted a state of emergency and pursued a series of massive purges of the military, the judiciary, the education system. More than 150,000 public servants were dismissed and tens of thousands were jailed for links to the alleged coup plotters. Excuse me. This is in addition to widely questioned judicial rulings on philanthropist Osman Kavala and leading Kurdish politician Selahattin Demirtas, among others, the jailing of dozens of politicians and journalists and the shuttering of more than 100 independent media outlets. Excuse me. Again, all this happened after the July 2016 coup attempts, but Yubek co-wrote a journal article in late 2015 arguing that Turkey at that point had become an authoritarian regime and that even back then it no longer satisfied even the minimal requirements of democracy. It's now been 5 years since you wrote that article, nearly 5 years, during which Turkey has pursued massive post-coup purges, as I mentioned, instituted an empowered presidential system, and continued its campaign against the PKK, Kurdish militants, and extended that campaign into Syria and Iraq, and nearly squeezed the life out of the pro-Kurdish party, the main pro-Kurdish party, the HDP. In fact, some people might argue that the summer or fall of 2015, when you were writing this journal article, is precisely when things started to get really bad in Turkey. But so if for you, 2015 Turkey was authoritarian and didn't satisfy even the minimal requirements of democracy, as your article argues, I wonder, how do you see the Turkey of today? Is it now a full-blown dictatorship?
Another excellent question, David. No, it's not yet, luckily, a full-blown dictatorship, because I think we need to pass a few more hurdles before we get there. You mentioned an article that I co-wrote with Dr. Şebnem Gümüşçü, and we claimed that Turkey at the time, in 2015, had a competitive authoritarian regime. And I still think that Turkey has a competitive authoritarian regime. Now, what we mean with that term, and it's not a term that we coined, but we're borrowing it from two other political scientists. In Turkey, you have elections that are regularly held, and all opposition parties, more or less, can contest these elections. And coming to power, the only legitimate way is to win those elections. So in that sense, there is some level of competition, and that really separates Turkey from fully fledged autocracies or even more hegemonic autocratic regimes around the globe. So, like Venezuela, like Russia, where you have, okay, elections, but the winner of those elections are predetermined. You know that Maduro in Venezuela or Chavez in Russia will win. Now, other regimes
Putin in Russia.
Putin in Russia. You have even more fully fledged autocracies in Egypt and North Korea and Saudi Arabia and so on, where you don't even have any sort of real elections. However, in the Turkish context, elections are still, the results of these elections are still not predetermined. And we've seen this in several occasions, June 2015 and June 2018 general elections. The AKP lost its parliamentary majority. And even more importantly, March 2019 local elections, just a little more than a year ago, the ruling party lost many of the important metropolitan municipalities. The reason why I still think that Turkey is authoritarian, in addition to all these examples that you mentioned, the problem in the Turkish context is that there is an uneven playing field between the ruling party and the opposition, such that this electoral competition or any other type of competition between the opposition and the government is unfair. And it's tilted in a way that that puts the ruling elite at an advantageous position, because you have a media crackdown, you have government pressure on civil society and universities, as well as political parties, that makes it quite difficult for opposition to thrive. and for people to freely join the opposition. The ruling party enjoys uneven access to public and private resources so that they can easily campaign in a way that brings all sorts of structural advantages to the ruling party candidates. And I think in your question, all the examples that you mentioned, the crackdown against the Kurdish political movement and the aggressive tactics of the government starting from mid-2015 in Turkey's southeast, as well as the arrests of so many HDP politicians, as well as philanthropists like Osman Kavala, many other journalists, they all fit under this category. Now, having said that, the reason why I think by 2015 Turkey was authoritarian is because starting from the AKP's second term, the AKP government has systematically captured state institutions, eroded rule of law, tried to nurture a pro-government business networks, as well as a pro-government media organizations, to such an extent that the opposition found itself at a very disadvantageous position vis-a-vis the government. And I think there were a number of turning points or critical events that happened much before 2015. Probably the Ergenekon and Balyoz trials were quite dubious and ended up really hurting the opposition. The 2010 referendum politicized the judge nomination process, which allowed the judiciary to come under the AKP's control over time. Of course, there was a fallout with the Gulen movement. Initially, Gulenists were also quite implicit in some of these encroachments on civil liberties and political rights. And then, of course, the 2013 Gezi protests and the enormous suppression that followed those protests basically ended up securitizing dissent. When we put all of these together, we decided that by 2015, Turkey was no longer authoritarian. It is probably much more authoritarian at this point, but still retains a lot of competitive elements, especially in the electoral arena. Probably one major change that happened from 2015 to 2020 is the monopolization of political power under the hands of Recep Tayyip Erdoğan, the current president of the country. Up until 2015, it was the AKP organization that was very much in charge. But by 2020, I think the ruling party, the AKP, has been cast aside and probably no longer plays as important a role as it did in the past. But it's now Erdoğan and a small circle of people around him. And so there is increasingly a neo-patrimonial structure on top of this competitive authoritarian regime.
To refer back to the initial part of your answer about competitive, the election aspect, it sounds like you're saying that if the Turkish government were to extend its crackdown on the pro-Kurdish HDP to the main opposition, CHP, this would go a long way toward making Turkey today an autocracy. And some have been expecting that and seen signs of it in talks of the government dismissing the CHP mayors of Ankara and Istanbul.
I partly agree with this with your analysis. However, I don't want to dismiss or take it lightly the fact that HDP has come under significant pressure. I think that alone would really turn the regime into quite an open autocratic regime.
Well, we could maybe even say that it is in the southeast and some of the
east. Yes. Exactly. So the literature is not exactly clear on this, but I think it is fair to suggest that in competitive authoritarian regimes, and Turkey is not the only one around the globe, there are several other cases. The level of competition actually varies from sector to sector. So, for instance, electoral arena in such regimes are a lot more competitive than, say, the political arena or the bureaucracy and so on. And also within the electoral arena, there is probably variation across regions. As you very well put it, the southeastern provinces, you have a much stronger autocratic regime against the opposition than in other parts of the country. So if the government decides to turn against CHP, I still doubt that they will take this too far. But if they were to turn against the main opposition party, then yes, almost the entire country will end up with a very strong autocratic regime. Erdogan will probably, or the regime will probably not want to tread along this trajectory, because there are all sorts of risks if they were to do it. It's much smarter for an authoritarian leader to remain competitive, at least in the electoral arena, because it gives you some popular legitimacy, it gives you some support in the international arena, and probably allows you to stabilize the situation a lot more easily than if this were to be a fully-fledged autocratic regime. So probably we're not necessarily going to see a total crackdown against the opposition mayors, but instead a standoff between the opposition mayors and the current government. Quite possibly the Istanbul mayor, Ekrem İmamoğlu, will be the watershed case to follow on this particular account.
Mm-hmm. We talked about your article from 2015, much more recently in a 2020 journal article for Party Politics, again, co-authored with Şebnem Gümüşçü. You make an argument that I don't think I'd heard before. Essentially, if I understood it right, the paper argues that the AKP's reliance on two primary support networks, business elites and the urban poor, and its distribution of resources to these partners in an increasingly corrupt manner led over time to a greater fear on the part of those receiving benefits that they would, if there were to be a change in government, they would lose those benefits. This, again, if I understand it correctly, had two results. It drove up the cost of the AKP keeping these groups on side, and in turn, it led to greater suppression of other critical groups because the AKP knew it now had ensured the support of its base. Taken together, all this led to significant democratic backsliding and the Turkey we have today. I'm sure I got some of this wrong, but if you would please provide some more detail on this argument, on this theory.
This is a very, this is a very good summary, by the way. It's completely an accurate depiction of our article. Yes, exactly. We are trying to, in that article, offer a political account or political economy account of the autocratization process in the Turkish context, and we actually also speculate that a similar process has happened in some other competitor authoritarian regimes, including Venezuela, South Africa, Hungary, and even maybe India. So we think that this is a much more general process. Now, our argument is that AKP over time became more authoritarian, and Erdogan ended up monopolizing more power within the ruling party because of the partisan resource distribution process that happened. AKP in office ended up increasingly funneling public contracts and all sorts of benefits to its supporters, both within the business community, but also in the media sector, as well as voters, so that also public bureaucracy, so that it ended up nurturing a very strong support base that saw AKP's continuation in office essential for their own private interests. And then, of course, juxtaposed to that, you have losers. Those people who have been, think of neighborhoods that vote for HDP and CHP that no longer receive a lot of municipality services from the AKP mayors. Or think of those business elites whose companies have been confiscated, or who no longer receive public contracts because they're in the opposition. Think of those civil servants who are not openly in support of AKP, who lost their jobs or who couldn't really get the raise or promotion that they really deserved, right? So in any sector that you look at, there is this partisan resource distribution process that ended up awarding or rewarding pro-AKP supporters and punishing its critics. Now, what this does short manner is that it increases the cost of toleration, not just for the AKP politicians, but also for its supporters. Because if you're getting public contracts, if you're getting jobs, if you're getting municipality services from the AKP government, either the national or the municipality government, then AKP's loss of power is intolerable for you because you're going to lose all that, right? So your cost of tolerance for any kind of opposition movement goes up, right? It becomes very costly to tolerate the opposition. Conversely, the cost of suppression goes down quite dramatically. In other words, the ruling party realizes that even if it were to use suppression against the opposition, it's really not going to make the party lose votes in the eyes of its own voters, right? Many journalists and academics treat this as polarization. Yes, there is polarization, but they do not quite explain why you have polarization in a country like Turkey. Yes, there are some cultural wedge issues, ideological polarization, such as the Hagia Sophia, but at the end of the day, AKP voters do not really tolerate suppression against Gezi Park protesters because they think that Hagia Sophia would be turned into a mosque. There are a lot more material reasons for that to happen, right? So in order to understand the AKP, in order to understand the current regime, follow the money trail, follow the distribution of the resources under this government, and you'll realize that it explains the increasing cost of toleration for the AKP base and the declining, decreasing cost of oppression for the same base. And of course, and Erdogan and some small group of people around him have become the chief politicians to manage this process. That's why they have increased their popularity. That's why they monopolized power. When you look at the people who've lost this Game of Thrones or this power battle within the AKP, those are the figures who were not really heavily involved in the resource distribution process. They were technocrats, they tried to manage the state, and then they realized that they did not really have much support because they didn't really matter so much for the AKP base.
Speaking of following the money trail, in the conclusion to this 2020 Journal article, you write that an economic shock that severely limits the AKP's ability to distribute the resources its partners have come to expect could alter the political calculus and lead to the disintegration of this mutual interdependence, this three-part coalition. You pointed to last year's local election results as an example. Looking ahead, I wonder if you see what's happening today, high unemployment and inflation, devaluation of the lira, significant foreign debt, as leading to the sort of economic shock your paper warns about.
Of course, the current economic downturn, of course, minimizes the amount of resources that can be distributed. And of course, this will not bode well for the ruling party in the coming months. And we've already seen that, actually, when you look at the number of votes that AKP has gotten over the years, there is quite a clear decline. Of course, they have not lost all of these elections and they're still in power. But when you look at the percentage share or the vote share of AKP, you see a clear decline starting from 2014 onwards. Since that time, AKP has had difficulty maintaining majority support, right? So the party gets plurality support, and within general elections, thanks to MHP support, it has survived. But otherwise, with the economic downturn and the shrinking economic base, things have changed quite dramatically. The party's electoral fortunes have changed quite dramatically. But very similar to what how I answered your Generation Z question, the fact that there is an economic downturn doesn't mean that the opposition will automatically gain from it. Of course, it provides more favorable conditions for the opposition to appeal to these voters. The so-called swing voters who have become disaffected and who are becoming more critical of the AKP government and its policies, particularly in the electoral arena. But in order for many of these AKP voters or former AKP voters to consider voting for the opposition parties need to convey a credible message that they will be able to win the election and upon coming to power, be able to stabilize the political situation and improve the Turkish economy. Unless they do that, it would still be very risky for many AKP voters to throw their support behind the opposition. Because imagine, if they don't believe that AKP will lose the next election, it's extremely risky for these voters to vote for the opposition, because then, as opposed to the past when they were in the winning column, they will move to the losing column. And then, of course, being in the losing side, they're going to lose a lot. They're going to lose these contracts. They're going to lose these municipality services and government benefits, social assistance, and so on, because you have a very partisan government. That's why, for me, the March 2019 local elections was so significant, because across the country, but particularly in major metropolitan municipalities, so many of these opposition mayoral candidates gave that image of being able to win. And so it created a self-fulfilling prophecy. Many of these swing voters who were sitting on the fence in previous elections because they did not think that the opposition had it in them, that the opposition can win the elections, in this particular cycle, decided that actually İmamoğlu and Mansur Yavaş and Zeydan Karalar and so many other opposition mayors, mayoral candidates can win. And indeed, they did win. So now the opposition, if they can do the same, they can repeat this performance in the presidential elections, I think we are up for very interesting times in the next few years.
Well, okay, last question for you. I mean, you mentioned this economic trouble and a decline in popularity for the AKP. I wonder if you think this might justify Erdogan or his party calling for early elections. This would beat a potential economic collapse. It would do it before these new parties of Davutoglu and Babacan are able to emerge and gain ground, and before, as you mentioned earlier, opposition parties are able to capture the youth vote and dissatisfied AKP voters.
That's right. I mean, I think that was the reason why many people within the ruling party contemplated calling for early elections, and quite possibly Erdogan's circle also gave serious thought to it. At the end of today, though, I still think it's a very risky option for Erdogan to call for early elections in 2020. For several reasons. One is obviously the economic collapse or the economic crisis that has followed the pandemic. As we've been discussing, Turkish economy was already experiencing a downturn by the time that the pandemic broke out, and the global pandemic has severely hurt Turkish economy, as it did, of course, other economies. So, you know, I don't think that it's a very good idea for Erdogan and his party to go for early elections amidst this global pandemic, both for its economic ramifications or economic risks, but also because logistically speaking, it's going to be very difficult to really organize an election. And who knows what the turnout rate will be. And, you know, if the turnout rate ends up being low, it could go either way. And also, so in addition to this risk, if you're Erdogan, you're elected until 2023. Calling for early elections in fall of 2020 will basically shorten your term for almost 3 years, which is 60% of your actual term. And since there is a two-term limit, according to the newly
revised... Also, we should mention that 2023 is, of course, a very important year for Turkey.
Yes, exactly. You know, it's going to be the 100th year of the Turkish Republic, and it's going to be a major anniversary. Because of the recently changed Turkish constitution, Erdogan can only run for the presidency twice. And this is now his first term. Why shorten that with 3 years? So I don't think, right, if I have to bet my money, I'm going to bet against any kind of early elections happening in 2020. Having said that, because of all the reasons that we've been discussing, Generation Z being against Erdogan on average more than the older generation, the risks of running against mayors who are opposition mayors who are becoming more popular, and of course these newly established splinter parties within the Islamist camp, Davutoğlu's and Babacan's parties, probably waiting until 2023 is also risky for Erdogan. So if I were to bet my money on a specific date, and this is pure speculation, but I have my reasoning, I would bet for either 2021 fall or 2022 spring for a couple of reasons. One, it will be a bit closer to the election time so that Erdogan will not really be losing a lot of years in his first term. Two, it may still be too soon for İmamoğlu or Yavaş to vacate the mayoralty in Istanbul and Ankara, respectively, and run against Erdogan. And also, probably by 2021, especially after the summer of 2021, Turkish economy will have improved a bit. We will be bouncing back from the global pandemic. I don't think that the global pandemic will continue for a year and a half. So probably we will start to go out and consume. Tourism sector will kick in. And for Turkish economy, tourism sector is extremely important. Turkey, I think, now has the seventh highest number of tourists around the globe. So Turkish economy is reaping enormous amounts of foreign currency from the tourism sector. So the economy will pick up by spring and summer of 2021. And then calling for elections by the fall of 2021 or spring of 2022 would give Erdogan that perfect moment, that most opportune moment of being able to compete against the opposition. It would still be an uphill battle for him. He's going to face a lot of opposition, but it will be, I think, for him, the most ideal time to call for early elections.
Interesting. So you don't see anything happening this year, but maybe a little bit more than a year from now, Turkey could be facing its next major election.
Turkish politics is interesting. I don't want to say 100% no, but my educated guess will be no early elections this year.
Okay, Berk Esen of Bilkent University, thanks so much for your time and insight. It's been a real pleasure.
Likewise, David. Thank you so much for the invitation.
You can follow Ahval News Online podcast series through Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube, Google Podcasts, SoundCloud, and Spreaker. All you need to know about Turkey is here for your ears, mind, and attention. Thank you for listening to our podcast.